The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Well, from one industry that faces staff shortages to another, our next guest has been thriving in the hospitality sector for almost 30 years. You might be familiar with Gary O'Hanlon's face from various TV shows. He's executive chef at the Condor Club, a luxurious chateau in France that costs €25,000 a night to rent out. We'll get to that shortly, along with his stint chefing near Stormont outside Belfast. But first, Gary, can we go back to where you're from? You're from Remelton in Donegal. Were you from the town or the countryside?
Yeah, well, we initially lived right in the town, right in Remelton in the back lane, we called it. And then when I was around 8 or 9, we moved probably about a mile and a bit out sort of in the Letterkenny side, you know. And Auchnagaddy would have been where that was, you know. And there's a big field right by our house, sort of behind Tara Friel's house, which is, we had this wee bridge over a wee burn, we called it, or a wee river. And then just the far side of that, then between like the main Letterkenny Road and the cluster of houses where we lived kind of off that road, there was a massive field there with a horse called Molly. So it got Chris and Molly's field. But there was loads of us around the same age living there between all the neighbours. And honest to God, we would be playing two-man hunt or football out there every single evening. I mean, we have a real close community group around that neck of the woods in Remelton, yeah, and we still all look out for one another.
And you look back and you think it was really, really wonderful, and then you realise it was just that there wasn't anything else to do.
Yeah, could have been that too. Well, it's true, like there really wasn't, you know. There was no phones, no smartphones, like gaming. I mean, we got an Atari from Santi and we were hardly ever allowed to play it, you know. Just get out into the fresh air and it was class.
And you had wider family there in the area. You had grannies. You had three grannies, had you, at one stage?
Yeah. Well, I probably have three or four, yeah. Well, Granny Hanlon, anyway, like Swilly Park and Remelton, if anybody knows Swilly Rovers, like, well, all the houses that are kind of wrapped around Swilly Rovers would have been my family's land, like on Daddy's side, you know, like Duncan, God rest him, and Granny died a few years back as well. And like right behind one of the goals would be the family farm. And then along the sideline, just up on the hill, would be like my Aunt Kate, Uncle Michael and Aunt Jean. Like, so that was, those houses before they became houses would have been where all the farming happened. Like they, I remember those fields gathering spuds there and following Daddy in a 135 and gathering potatoes, because everybody chipped in back then. And then some of the other fields at the other side was where the hay was growing, you know what I mean? So that was where we spent a lot of time. And then Mammy's family, like, so Granny Gallagher, like Granny Josie as we call her, she's still alive. And then there would have been Granny Tiger, who was like, she was the
Granny Tiger.
Yeah, well, Granny Tiger was probably
not to be messed with.
Not to be messed with. No, she was kind of named after the dog. Like, so she had a beautiful Labrador called Tiger, and my uncle-in-law Joe, like, that was his mother. And I would have often stayed with my Aunt Kate, like she was my godmother, whenever Joe would have worked nights. And when they were building their house, they had a mobile right beside Granny Tiger, and I often stayed there. But she would have been the first, like, exposure to good bacon and amazing scones, treacle bread in particular. I always remember standing in books at her sink and her, just, she never used the recipe. I mean, for bacon, that's really, really rare. You know, it was all hands, all touch, which was a nightmare, because as the years went on, I would often went to Anna, was her name, Anna Buchanan, you know, and Granny Tiger could never ever replicate a recipe onto paper and give it to me. So I would try and make it side by side with her. She sadly passed just a couple of years ago, you know. But I mean, she smoked like a train. I don't know how she lasted as long as she did. I never saw a person that smoked as much as Anna did. But yeah, the first real exposure to amazing flavour and bacon would have come from her.
And were you getting dinners in all these houses?
My grandfather Duncan, God rest him, he christened me the Grey Crow at one stage, you know. It used to annoy me so much. But I had figured out, he used to go to the marts all the time. He only ever had a tractor, a 135. He used to go to the mart in Mulford. So Granny used to make dinner at 11 o'clock in the morning because he'd be away all day. So I'd always just happen to find myself snooking around Granny's at 11 in the morning and, you know, give me a wee bit of that or a wee bit of this or whatever. But Granny would always throw you up a plate anyway, but it used to drive him mad. He'd be sitting there eating his orange as well before he left. and I would have to have a segment of that as well. And then my Aunt Kate, she had her dinner at 1 o'clock, and then Mammy always had dinner around four or five in our own house. So I used to figure out a way of getting three dinners a day. I mean, I was skin and bones, you know, like, I mean, back then I ate more than I ever ate and I was skinny. Maybe that's what I need to start doing again, is eating dinner for breakfast.
But what's interesting, as you describe it, even when you were very young, you didn't just enjoy eating the baking and the food. You were watching. Like, you had an interest in how this is put together.
Yeah. You know, I think of Sonny as well, you know, like, he'd be a cousin of my dad's, like, Sonny Gallagher used to always come to our house. And God, when I think, like, of the bad bread Sonny had to endure that I would have been making, I was always trying to make something. And you know, funny enough, a lot of it was down to maybe an affinity to Mammy or whatever. Like, you know, Mammy would have been at home and she'd be there making the dinner, and I would get annoyed, like, I'd be driving a boot and pierce or whatever to say, like, get up and help. So, you know, Daddy might have been out farming or doing something and Mammy would be making the dinner and say, look, I want to, you know, keep her happy or maybe help her. And it was amazing, all the, you know, whether it be knife skills or peeling a spud or peeling a carrot or all these little skills that you're just chomping in to help her, really, or maybe to try and get a sweet or something off her, like, and help, and anything at all to maybe get a sweet I would have been trying to do. But you're learning and you're grasping it. But definitely, like, there was a trait really early that I was always being pulled towards the kitchen, and I loved getting stuck in there. Maybe not so much when the floor brushing was happening or the floor mopping was happening, but definitely.
And the more interesting bits, the creative bits.
And the creative bits, yeah, like, I wanted to be in there.
At what point did you decide you wanted to be a chef?
Yeah, I would say really, really early. Like, my Aunt Dette was in the Rosapenna, but I mean, we never went down there. It was always too fancy, and we wouldn't have been going in there or anything, you know what I mean? So I couldn't give you any romantic story that I walked through the kitchen to see her one day. But, you know, I always do remember, like, the night of my 21st, Tank, as we call him, like, Mark Coyle, a neighbour of ours, he threw 50 quid up in the bar, and I says, oh, what's that for? He goes, well, I owe you that from the first day going to Unions. But he always remembered this conversation, and I says, well, I'm going here, like, but I mean, I'm going to be a chef anyway. I said, so whatever, I just have to get through this. Don't really want to go to Unions. But, and I was good at school.
And that was day one of secondary school.
Day one, walking to the bus, yeah, he remembered the conversation, and because he had said to me, nobody knows what they want to do. And I says, well, look, I mean, the only other thing I might be is a pilot. I says, but no, like, I'm definitely going to be a chef. So I knew that once I was old enough, and I turned 15 the day after my junior cert finished. And I remember thumbing to Downing's and stayed with my Auntie Kathleen that summer and every summer thereafter. So my first day in the Rosapenna kitchens on the pots. And again, Mr. Casey at the time, like, that owns the place, you know, you weren't getting a job on the pots unless you wanted to become a chef either. So, you know, he was adamant, like, if you're coming in here and you're taking up a place, because, I mean, you were washing the pots, but in the Rosapenna in those days, you were responsible for two potato dishes per night and three vegetable dishes of different colour and different texture per night. And so the training was unbelievable.
There's a lot of pressure there. Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved the Rosapenna. Yeah, it was unbelievable. James McBride, who's still a sous chef there to this day, he started on the pots. Would have probably started that same summer of 93. And that was it. Like, I was in the kitchen. And back then, you know, there wasn't as many steamers or ovens doing what they do now, or machines. I mean, back then it was all big pots, and, you know, you covered the spuds with cold water and you cooked them, the carrots, the same, and the greens.
Big pots and big burns.
Big pots, big burns, yeah. But, you know, we're always careful. Like, I mean, I don't want to jinx myself. I mean, I've only ever had maybe two fairly decent cuts, but never a really, really bad burn. And there was a lot more opportunity to get burned back then, because I was really, I mean, I'm overweight now and I'm big and I'm heavy and the stereotypical chef, but God, back then, you know, I used to pray to put on weight. I wouldn't have been 8 stone wet, soaking wet playing football. I was so tiny. And I remember, you know, when the spuds used to get delivered, James was a big strong man, and I always used to say, please let there be a delivery today, because when you come into the kitchen or in the corridor there as a penna, the spuds were always in it. There was a real cool sort of dry area where the dry veg was kept. But if the potatoes were stacked high, I used to be able to just flip them onto my shoulders, walk up the two flights of stairs into the main kitchen, and it was easy. But if they were on the ground, 20 kilo, I mean, I'd lift 20 kilo now and a dumbbell. But back then, I was like busting a gut like to try and lift it. So it was tough work, but it was an unbelievable environment. And all you were really trying to do is, all you really wanted was to be noticed, do your work well, do it clean, do it precise. impress Det or impress Mr. Casey and get yourself into the main kitchen. And you know, by the end of that first summer, I was already in pastry alongside Helen. She was the head pastry chef. You know, you would do wee bits to help them out, and they always wanted you.
All the time.
They always wanted you alongside them. I was like, going, I'm not learning anything in there washing a pot. So at the end of the night, let it all stack up. You're in the kitchen as long as you can, then get into pots, and for 2 hours, you just scrubbed, washed, and walked the beach home.
So you trained and you began really career and your full working life as a chef. Where did that start then?
My first job away from college and fully graduated would have been in Stormont leading up to the Good Friday Peace Talks. Like around that time in Stormont Hotel, literally opposite the Castle building.
That's at the beginning of the big long avenue that people can see.
The Hastings Group, I would have worked for the Hastings Group there. Like, and that was in East Belfast. So like I'd been in a placement in Dundalk and bumped into a guy there, the head chef of La Scala, which is one of the restaurants in the hotel. He happened to be from Dundalk. Got talking to him, and you know, I was going out with a girl from Balbafay at the time who's a chef as well. So he says, look, I goes, we'd love to hire you, you know. So we went up there, and
that would have been an interesting time in the north, in around Stormont. There would have been politicians coming and going to the hotel.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ian Paisley, I got to know Ian really well. You know, he would have been in every evening. A really, really nice guy. I mean, obviously, you know, he was a pivotal part of the whole peace process as well. You know, I mean, a staunch unionist for sure. You know, David Trimble was always there. Ian, John Hume, like, was just an amazing man. It was amazing to be around him.
And so Ian Paisley would be in for his dinner?
They ate there. You know, Monday to Friday, La Scala in particular was a business restaurant, really. Like, there would have been talks going on over at Stormont. Obviously, there was hospitality over there too, but they were often over with us. He was a big fan of salmon and a Guinness batter, and even if it ever came off the menu, he would, oh, chef, any chance? And I would say, oh, aye, no bother. And you'd have to, you know, give him whatever he want. Ronnie Flanagan would have been the head of the RUC at the time, and you would have had armed guards at the hotel gate, armed guards outside the restaurant. Ronnie Flanagan off the net, everyone's well aware. Like it was a real volatile time, like around there, and to be living in East Belfast, you know, leading into all of that, it was.
But you, as you describe it, you sound like you loved it.
Honest to God, like I was so focused on just becoming a better chef. Like, you know, McMaster's was a finer restaurant within that hotel, and I would often do a night a week up there. Function wise, it was there was a German pastry chef. He was unbelievable. I always remember he had this wee bike and cart where he took all his patisserie stuff with him. He used to cycle up the Newton Ards Road up in there to the hotel. He was a great guy. He knew if he had 32 brulees and 54 truffles, he had them counted. And quite often, I was the mouse that was trying to eat one. You'd see him coming because there was this block sort of frosted glass from the kitchen, and I would have been maybe up in the pastry kitchen doing a wee bit of dipping, and you'd see him coming, stomping in, looking for me, you know what I mean? I was like, I never saw anybody with stock control as good as that dude. He must have been a dream for the business, you know? But I was really making headway. La Scala was busy. It was serious, serious pressure. We're doing a couple of hundred people a night. But look, you know, that's life, and kitchens are tough places, or they used to be tougher places, certainly, you know what I mean? Like, but definitely.
Has that changed, do you think? Because sometimes the whole celebrity chef phenomenon, we talk about the Gordon Ramsay thing as well, it is presented as being a powder keg and a volatile place. Well, what do you make of all that celebrity chef
stuff? Look, you know, I hate to hear all of that, you know, like everybody kind of asks us, you know, and Gordon Ramsay, you know, like, yeah, it's in there and he's shouts and roars or does whatever. I mean, it's a loud environment. Kitchens are loud environments, you know what I mean? So definitely, like, when things get hot and heavy in service, you know, would you mind passing me the foie gras? Would you mind passing me, you know, the black cod or whatever it is? Like, 10 seconds, 5 seconds is the difference between a piece of soul being amazing, perfect, or just fecked, ruined. You know what I mean? So it's real high tempo. Now, that's not an excuse for shouting, roaring or abuse. Once service goes well and it's high octane and there's never anything personal, there's definitely, it's almost very hard to explain to somebody that's never been in that environment that, you know, it being loud and being frantic, it's just so normal. You know, if you stand at any takeaway any night after a bar or a nightclub and you look in and there's 50 people at a counter in a wee rural takeaway and they're all running around. It looks like they're all running around like headless chickens, but there's a method to all the madness, and it's all go, 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 go. Very methodical. And service can just fall in a split second. Like, the pressure on the head chef on any given night at the highest level is insane.
In the chateau in France, then, are the guests, they're obviously very wealthy guests, are they very security conscious?
You know, high net worth individuals, yeah, they are. We have 24-hour security on the site. It's 300 acres and the whole 300 acres is gated as well. It's completely covered in cameras. So, yeah, we would have security on site, monitored right there. You know, two guys by day, two guys by night.
And would some of them actually bring their own?
Yeah, well, you'd have that as well, yeah. I mean, look, I can't obviously get into individual clients, but they're definitely, like, dependent. Most of them would have their own security, but then they don't really need them to come.
If you had to summarise, what kind of guests are they generally who are booking it out?
Well, business people, really, you know. Obviously, you know, we get well-known faces as well. I mean, I'm not going to talk about who comes or who doesn't come on an individual basis, but, you know, most of them are just successful business people, company owners. We get a lot of corporate guests coming on bonding, you know, working trips as well.
When you look at the hospitality industry in general now after COVID, there are a lot of staff shortages. A lot of people drifted away from it with all the restaurant closures and all of that. I mean, is it an industry that you would still recommend to people to get into?
Absolutely. Look, it's given me an unbelievable life. It's brought me around the world. I think, though, no matter what you do, you definitely have to work harder than the guy beside you. You have to be very, very driven, doing pots, doing whatever. I mean, I could tell you now, there's nothing glamorous. I mean, when I'm at the Condor, there's nothing glamorous about, you know, peeling prawns at 6 o'clock in the morning or working hard or, you know, making a stock and leaving it on all night or braising something all day. It's like, but that customer experience of knowing that you're in total control of somebody coming to somewhere so prestigious, it will give you an unbelievable life. You could open your own place. You could go to Kerry Global, work in the food service industry, do the degree. The culinary arts programs now are all degree programs. You know,
and you don't know where it's going to take.
You don't know where it's going to take. You could be anything. You could be in a lab in Beloit, Wisconsin, working for Kerry Global, or you could be lucky enough to be standing in the pastry room of Chapter One with Michael Villanen. You could be down in the tannery with Paul Flynn teaching you how to cook. I mean, the opportunities that are there, and any country in the world you could live in and make a living in. And I mean any country. What a life it can give you.
Well, you certainly know how to sell it. Gary O'Hanlon, executive chef at the Condor Club in France. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.